From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Murray Pariah, one of the great pianists of our time, about playing and not playing. For several years during the 90s, a hand injury prevented him from playing. During that time, he studied the music of Bach. When he started playing again, he focused on Bach. He's since recorded Bach's English suites, Goldberg variations, and keyboard concertos. He finds beauty, complexity, and spirituality within the music. Murray Pariah, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A chartered American passenger jet is parked at an airport on China's Hainan Island, waiting to take 24 Americans home. CNN video shows a bus alongside the plane with a crowd of people standing by. China held the air crew members for 11 days after their Navy surveillance plane made an emergency landing after colliding with a Chinese jet fighter. Chinese officials released the jet after the Bush administration sent a letter saying the U.S. is very sorry for the death of the Chinese pilot and for making an unauthorized landing in China. NPR's Rob Gifford said it's not yet clear whether the Chinese public will be satisfied with the resolution.
Some of them have been very angry, and I think some are still angry and think that an apology is not enough. They say a Chinese life has been lost here. Some people really felt that the crew should have been held. But I think a lot of people feel that this incident did need to be finished. It needed to be over, and China-US relations needed to get back onto an even keel. So it's very much related to the Chinese media and how the government has presented this. 2 years ago, when the Chinese embassy was bombed in Belgrade, there was a lot of anger, and it was very hard to calm down the populace. And that's partly because it was portrayed in the media in such militant terms. If it's played down as it has been in the last 10 days in the Chinese media, then perhaps the Chinese people are less likely to be angry. I think a lot of people feel that they do want to move on.
NPR's Rob Gifford in Beijing. The plane is scheduled to take the crew members to Guam, where they'll stop briefly before heading on to Hawaii. Emergency officials in South Africa say a stampede at a soccer stadium has left at least 50 people dead. NPR's Kenneth Walker reports from Johannesburg.
The soccer fans apparently were trying to enter a game between the country's two biggest teams. A live broadcast by the State Broadcasting Corporation reported that bodies were scattered inside and outside the stadium in downtown Johannesburg. Helicopters ferried injured to local hospitals and bodies to the city's mortuary. The game was stopped after 17 minutes. Officials of the federal government rushed to the scene to calm the remaining crowd and provide contact numbers for family members concerned about relatives at the game. The incident apparently marks the greatest tragedy in the history of South African soccer. Kenneth Walker, NPR News, Johannesburg.
Parts of Colorado and Wyoming have been paralyzed by a powerful spring blizzard. Some areas have gotten as much as 18 inches of snow, and it's being whipped up by winds gusting to 70 miles an hour. The storm knocked out power to more than 120,000 people and forced the closure of the Denver airport. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 83 points to close at 10,019. Declines led advances in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 50 points, or 2.7%, to close at 1,902. This is NPR News. Two Democrats have emerged from the crowded field of candidates in Los Angeles' mayoral election. The city's election chief said former state assembly speaker Antonio Villaraigosa got 30% of the vote, followed by city attorney James Hahn with 25%. They'll face each other in a runoff in June. People with Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia often die much sooner than earlier studies indicated. NPR's Richard Knox reports on the article in the New England Journal of Medicine.
The study, done in Canada, finds that people with Alzheimer's and other dementias typically live only a little more than 3 years after their condition is diagnosed. That's dramatically less than the 5 to 9 years in previous studies. In terms of survival, the new finding puts dementia in the same league as aggressive cancers. The problem with earlier research, the study authors say, is that many people with dementia died before they could be enrolled. When researchers took that into account, the time from diagnosis to death was much shorter. But some say the new study may itself be misleading. Those enrolled were nearly 84 years old on average. People whose dementia is diagnosed at younger ages can probably expect to live longer. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
A judge in Birmingham, Alabama, has given prosecutors permission to use a secretly recorded tape in their case against a former Ku Klux Klan member accused of the 1964 church bombing that killed four young girls. Thomas Blanton Jr. is scheduled to be tried for the crime beginning on Monday. The tape was recorded by the FBI using a listening device that was planted under Blanton's kitchen sink. Defense lawyers say the listening device was illegal back in 1964. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the great pianists of our time, Murray Pariah. In the London Times, he was described as one of the piano's most lyrical contemporary poets. His career was launched in 1972 after winning the Leeds International Piano Competition. He's since performed with leading orchestras around the world and has made many acclaimed recordings. But for a few years, he was unable to play because of a hand injury. During this frustrating hiatus, he studied the music of Bach. Last year, he recorded Bach's Goldberg Variations. Now he has a new recording of Bach Keyboard Concertos. He's not only the featured soloist, he conducts the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. Let's start with music from this new CD. This is the Keyboard Concerto No. 1 in D minor. That's Murray Pariah at the piano, also conducting the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields from his new CD of Bach Keyboard Concertos. Murray Pariah, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Now, we actually started this interview a few weeks ago, but you were in terrible back pain. You had a very unusual back attack, and yes. You just couldn't go on.
That's right. I won't forget that because it's also the first time in my life I ever suffered from such a thing. But I think what it was that I was practicing on a piano in my room, which had casters on, and therefore the pedals were very high, and it required a lot of effort. And so somehow, after a few, maybe 7 hours of practicing, I found myself in a lot of pain, and I couldn't move.
Now, this was at the very beginning of a concert tour, and
yes.
What happened at that night? Didn't you have a performance that night?
The next day, and luckily I made it. I was able to see somebody that gave me massage and somebody that gave me acupuncture, and I also saw a doctor, so it relieved the pain. And miraculously enough, even though they all said I would be better and I didn't believe them, I was better by the following night.
Do you ever play when you're in pain?
Well, you know, when I'm playing, I forget about everything, so that I might be in pain right before it, and the pain might be excruciating right after, but at the moment I'm playing, I don't feel any pain.
And that's because?
Who knows?
It's probably a combination of being totally lost in the music and also adrenaline.
It must be. I remember injuring one of my fingers long, long time ago when I was about 17 and I had to play a Shostakovich quintet. And I told my teacher that I don't think I can do the performance because I injured my finger. He said, you won't feel a thing without any medicine or anything. And it was absolutely true. I didn't feel a thing.
Now, Murray Pariah, on your new CD, you have a dual role. You're both soloist and conductor. Why would you want to conduct and perform as a soloist?
Well, I find it's a lot of fun. I love the contact with the orchestra. I love the one-to-one relationship I have with them, especially an orchestra of the quality of the St. Martin's in the Field, where I have a very warm personal relationship with many of the players. It's just like a chamber music experience for me. It's a wonderful sense of fun and excitement.
So you're conducting from the piano?
Well, conducting is too strong a word for what I do in the Bach concertos, which is mainly leading, because there's hardly a moment that I have to lift my hands or to do any real conducting. But it would more apply to, say, if I was doing Mozart concertos, where I feel, to shape the phrases.
So what are you doing to conduct?
I'm leading the rehearsals, telling the direction of the phrase, talking where I feel the harmonic emphasis is, and trying to shape the piece to a kind of a vision so that it, I feel, holds organically together. That's what I'm doing.
Now, what are you thinking, if anything, when you're performing and you're deep into a piece? Are you...
I'm always involved in the line. It's very hard to explain what the line is of a piece, especially to a non-musician, but it's the sort of thing that keeps the thing up. You know, we, as musicians, have to fight gravity. Gravity is down, and we have to keep the thing flowing and the thing up. And I'm always involved in that aspect of things, whether it be through rhythm or whether it be through dynamic inflection or whether it be through sense of direction going towards a certain place and then coming away from a certain place. Anything to keep it from being grounded.
Now, forgive a real amateur's question about this. When you're thinking about rhythm, are you ever counting?
Occasionally, but more, it's more abstract. It's more, I will think, for instance, about long phrases, and that involves rhythm. In other words, four bars are in one breath, let's say. And it's an instinctive thing that's almost a part of the body. It's not something that you're consciously aware of once you've decided it.
Now, you talk about breath, but you're playing with your hands. It's not a wind instrument. Do you still think in terms of breath?
Very
because
much.
You're breathing.
Very much, because I'm singing, even if I'm not opening my voice. I'm singing through the piano, and this is... involves breath and involves even breath control, all kinds of things that are sort of imaginary, but they're very important.
Did you have to learn how to keep breathing in a relaxed way while you're performing?
I think about relaxation occasionally, most often not when I'm performing, but when I'm practicing, and to try to be aware of when I'm tensing too much so that the music is actually being compressed and not being allowed its full throttle. But somehow in the performances, it's not something uppermost in my mind.
What is uppermost in your mind? The line that
the
you were talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, your new CD is of Bach keyboard concertos. What is the importance of these concertos in his body of work?
Well, in his body of work, I think they were probably more of a sense of relaxation for him, because he used to have coffee concerts. And these were played at these coffee concerts, which would be on Sunday, to probably it's about 150, 200 people that would come into this thing. And I recently saw an advertisement for one of these coffee concerts where he said he was going to play on an instrument that had never been heard before. This was 1730. And most likely that instrument would not have been a harpsichord, but an early, very early forte piano, which they were building in those days. So it is conceivable that Bach had played an early, let's say, version of the piano.
You've been recording a lot of Bach lately. Do you understand your affinity with his music?
Understand it completely, I don't. But I think that Bach is the essence of music, that Bach, through his logic and through his comprehensiveness, made every note follow the next so inevitably and at the same time with so much surprise that he influenced the rest of music. Nobody could compose really the same way once they had been exposed to Bach's music.
Can you talk about what you hear emotionally and what the challenges are technically in Bach's music?
You know, Bach taught his students and what was very important for him from the very beginning was the chorale. And the chorale is the sort of backbone of the Lutheran service. And this chorale, believe it or not, permeates all the secular works, all the keyboard works. There are underlying chords which provide the sort of main places where one leads to in these pieces that underline all the ornamentation and all the flashy sort of finger work that is above them. And so somehow the main key to Bach is to understand the underlying, let's say, chordal progression, which is like a chorale, and its emotion. They're all different. There's not one piece of Bach that's like another piece of Bach. And they all have a somewhat different, what he would call affect, A-F-F-E-C-T, which is the emotional tone, the emotional atmosphere. In many sense, he has put words to these things through the cantatas. And they all have to do with one's relationship to God or one's relationship to a higher being. And there's all aspects of the emotions, sadness, joy, sorrow, pain, everything you can imagine, and all its different levels as well. But these have to be sought after. You have to find the right effect of the piece, and usually it'll stay for the whole movement. And at the same time, the technique will be how to incorporate the sound so that they sound inevitable, growing out of these chords that I say are at the root of the music.
Pianist Murray Pariah is my guest. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is pianist Murray Pariah, and his new CD is a recording of Bach's Keyboard Concertos numbers 1, 2, and 4. You recently recorded the Goldberg Variations. For listeners who don't know the story of how Bach created it, could you give us the short version of that story?
Well, the story is related by Forkel, who was the first biographer of Bach and had access and was a good friend, in fact, to his sons, especially Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. And he would be telling this story that Bach was commissioned by a count, Count Keiseling, to write a piece for him that would while away the hours that he couldn't sleep at night. And this would be played to him by one of Bach's proteges, namely Goldberg. I don't know how much of the story is true. People nowadays tend to doubt it because if Count Keiseling would actually commission Bach, there would have been a dedication on the front piece of the copy or some kind of acknowledgement. On the other hand, Count Keiseling was a close friend of Bach, and it might have been, let's say, an informal arrangement. One thing we do know was that Goldberg was an incredible harpsichordist, and he was very young. He was about 14 years old when he would have been playing this. He died at the age of 21 and was known for being able to sight read anything and play everything with a nimbleness and a fleetness and also an understanding that belied his years. So I think there's a lot of credibility to the story because I think that rather than provide a sleeping pill, as some people would have said, this music was, which it certainly isn't. There's nothing sleep-inducing about the Goldberg Variations. I think it would give him comfort spiritual comfort, solace during, let's say, a troubled night. And because the music speaks of joy, of radiance, and certainly towards the end of some kind of spiritual salvation, if you want.
Can you choose one of the variations and discuss what's going on technically and emotionally?
If I would choose one variation, it would probably be the 25th, which is in the minor, and it's the longest variation, and in a way it's the most harrowing variation because it has all these chromatic notes, and it talks a language that up to that point in the piece, Bach didn't talk. Up to that point, one was amazed or awed by the wizardry of the canons and all of the incredible virtuosity. But suddenly at this point, the music becomes much, much slower. And what I feel happens is a depiction of the crucifixion, something very, very disturbing and completely disturbing the whole equilibrium of the piece. I think it takes the next few variations to overcome this disturbance.
Well, why don't we hear that 25th variation in Bach's Goldberg Variations performed by Murray Pariah. That's Murray Pariah from his recent recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations. Murray Pariah, you've said that whether you are religious or not, if you perform these pieces, you will find a spirituality inherent within them. Do you look for spirituality in music? Is that one of the things that has made you live there?
I don't look for it, and yet I find it all over the place. It is there. Because one of the, I think, needs of a human being is this kind of spirituality, simply put, as to belonging in, to something bigger than oneself. It could take many forms, and there are many different evocations of this sense. But you want, at your deepest moments, to believe, A, that you're not alone, that there's a meaning, that there's an organic meaning, and that somehow everything fits, that everything is part of a bigger whole. I think that's the sphere that music brings one in. It's not just playing notes, and it's not just nice notes, and it's not just pretty notes. It's some deeper sphere of one's emotional needs. And I think that deepest sphere is to feel a part of something bigger.
Now, a lot of the pieces that you interpret were written by people who were writing to perform this music in churches. Does that create any kind of barrier for you since you were raised Jewish?
No, I don't think, by the way, the Goldberg Variations is a was meant for a church. It was meant for the privacy of one's home. Whether one would have heard the whole piece, I don't know. That's a questionable aspect to it. That probably certain variations would have been played rather than the whole piece at that time. It was Mendelssohn, actually, who introduced the choral music to a much wider audience and therefore brought it into the concert hall. Also, he was, well, his family was Jewish. He had converted. I don't think that the actual religion that one is given or that one believes in, I don't think that that, in a sense, materially offers, alters the idea of spirituality, really.
This sense of spirituality that you find in music, did you experience that when you were young and learning to play? Or did that come later?
I think to realize what it was came later. To realize that it's not just pretty notes, that it's something of a deep significance that could be termed spirituality. It's a very difficult area to define. That came later. But I think I always loved music passionately from when I was 4 years old.
Murray Pariah will be back in the second half of the show. Here's more from his recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations. This is variation number 14. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Not Playing. We continue our conversation with pianist Murray Pariah and talk about the hand injury that kept him from performing for several years and how that hiatus changed his approach to music.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with pianist Murray Pariah. He recently recorded Bach's English Suites and Goldberg Variations. On his new CD, he performs Bach keyboard concertos. He immersed himself in Bach when a hand injury prevented him from playing. I spoke with Pariah about that injury. There was a period of about 5 years when you had to stop performing. You had an infection in your thumb that developed into a bone spur. Why was this so difficult to treat?
Good question. I don't know. Part of the reason was that instead of taking care of the infection, I just took 2 days of the antibiotics, and then since I was fine, stopped taking them. And I think that that was a no-no.
So I'm wondering what it was like for you to go through a period of several years without being able to play, since so much of your life revolves around performance.
It's not even performance, you know.
Right, exactly, just playing in general.
Playing in general, because playing for me is, in a way, more fulfilling than speaking. It's an aspect of expressing myself. And it was, in a way, to have your tongue or something cut off and not be able to speak, really, to speak the way you wanted to speak.
So were there other ways that you had to relate to music when you couldn't play? Was listening satisfying?
Well, that's what I did. I listened, and I listened even away from, the record player. I just listened in my mind through to the scores. I needed a lot of Bach. I don't know particularly why. I think probably the spiritual solace we were talking about was very important to me. Also, Bach is for me the essence of music. It's not to say it's the only composer or my favorite composer. I love all the composers, but as I said, I don't think that Bach, that without Bach, there would have been anybody, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven. And so I listened to a lot of Bach, and I studied a lot of scores.
What did you get from having this hiatus in which you had the time to just study scores?
In a way, with hindsight, I would say it was a great blessing, because I was able also to study analysis, to study counterpoint and harmony, all of these things that if I was practicing, I wouldn't do. And you get a perspective of what music is about that is more important than actually playing the instrument. You get to the essence of what music is about.
Could you maybe describe a little more what you mean about that?
Well, the laws of harmony and the laws of counterpoint are, for me, essential laws in order to understand what shapes music. Why is this note there? Why not another note? It's not only a composer's whim that puts it there. They have to subscribe to a lot of laws of tonality, in other words, of dissonant treatment, how you use a dissonant and when you introduce it and how you resolve it. All these questions that are about the tensions that are in music. Now, a chance to study this without technical preoccupations, without worrying about your fourth finger or your fifth finger or whatever, it's a very important opportunity because it gets you into the composer's shoes. And so, in a way, I was very grateful to have that time off.
Did you listen to any of your own CDs during that period?
No, I find that too painful because I feel that, I made this mistake and I made that mistake. I don't have the poise to listen to a lot of my older records.
Now, does music function different for you as a listener than as a player?
Inevitably, a little bit it does, but my aim is that it doesn't. In other words, so that I can be aware of the music and be aware of what the music is doing at the moment that I'm playing. But that's very difficult because you're involved in your technical limitations or your technical whatever it is in order to play the piece. You're involved in spontaneity, things that come from the moment, because it's an emotional act, first and foremost. And therefore, it's hard to listen as objectively, let's say, or as completely as when one is listening to a record. But my aim is to be able to listen to the music and to really appreciate the music at every moment that I'm playing.
Did you have to deal with depression during that period when you couldn't
play? A bit,
play?
Yes. It got to the point. I'm not an easily depressed person. I'm not one that has depressions easily. But I found towards the end of this trauma in a way that when the doctors were saying that they couldn't see what the problem is, or that if they could, they didn't think there was much hope of solving it. At that point, I got pretty depressed, yes.
Well, how was it solved?
How was it solved?
Yeah, how was your finger finally fixed?
Oh, it was finally diagnosed in the States, and then I had a very good surgeon in England who operated it, and it came back.
When you started playing again, what music did you start with, and why did you choose that?
I started with Mozart because somehow I was most familiar with the Mozart, and I thought that would put less pressure on me. And so when I had concerts to come back to, as in February, I think, were my first concerts, I was supposed to play the Beethoven Emperor Concerto. Instead, I played some of the Mozart concertos.
Did your fingers remember what to do? And I'm wondering, what won out when you started playing again, the joy of being able to play again, or the frustration of being rusty?
No, actually, for some reason, I think probably because I started very young playing the piano, the rustiness didn't last very long. And within a week or 2 weeks, quite amazingly, I was able to regain the facility. It's when you start lessons very young, you get a certain amount of facility that stays with you your whole life. And therefore, I was lucky in that way. So it wasn't the rustiness, but it was the great joy of playing again and not taking something for granted that one took for granted one's whole life. You always thought you could play, and suddenly you saw that you couldn't. And then when it came back, you were so grateful that it was just mind-blowing.
Do you think your playing is any different now than it was before the problem that you had?
It probably is. I'm the least capable to judge because I'm so close to it. It's like your children. You can't see them grow. But I do think that the study that I went through, the analysis of the scores, studying the counterpoint, doing the kind of work I did, inevitably made the interpretations deeper. There's no way that it couldn't have.
Pianist Murray Pariah is my guest. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is pianist Murray Pariah. His new CD is a recording of Bach keyboard concertos. You grew up in the Bronx, but I believe you weren't born in the United States. Where were you born?
No, I was born in the United States, and I was spent all my life in New York, in fact, in the Bronx, until I was about 22, 23. Then started to travel a little bit with the Leeds competition when I was 25. Then got an apartment in London and spent half the time in London, half the time in the States, and gradually got to spend more and more time in England, partly because of engagements and partly because I've just felt so comfortable with the musical scene there. And it was also easier to travel from there to the European concerts I was doing. So eventually settled down there. And actually now, for the last 20, 23, 24 years there, I've lived there.
You started playing piano, I believe, at the age of 4.
That's right.
Was it your idea or your parents' idea?
No, it was always my idea. My parents, I think, gratefully, did not know too much about music, though my father wanted me to pursue music. He didn't know enough about it to really be a hindrance in that pursuit. What he did was he took me to the opera when I was very young, 4 years old. And I loved it so much that I came back singing some of the arias from it. And so therefore, he thought I should get a piano and work with a neighborhood teacher. And she soon had me graduated to a bigger piano. And I loved to improvise. I didn't like to practice so much. In fact, I don't think I started seriously practicing till I was around 15. But I would be improvising and sort of making arrangements of tunes that I had heard at the opera, let's say, or other things, Spanish tunes. My father loved Spanish music, and so therefore I would arrange Spanish music for him. That was the bulk of my musical activities at first. And then I started seriously with a teacher, Jeanette Hain, was my principal teacher from around the age of 6 till 17.
Were you considered a prodigy, and did you have the pressures on you that so many prodigies have?
Well, I think I was considered a prodigy, but my teacher made sure that I didn't give concerts so that I didn't have those pressures, and I didn't give a real concert till I was 17.
Were you prone to stage fright?
No, it's funny. At the beginning, I had absolutely no stage fright. That came later.
Oh, it did come later?
Yeah, I don't know why.
When did you start getting it?
I guess when the responsibilities became more. And I think in my early 20s, it became more difficult for me.
And now?
I still have it. I think I can deal with it. But it's not the easiest thing in the world, no.
Now, you said when you were 15 or 16 is when you started really taking piano seriously. That's and when your training took a more serious turn, too. What happened then to make you more serious about playing?
It's a good question. I don't know, but I think what it was that I went to music camp. This would have been Blue Hill. Later on, I went to the Marlborough Music Festival and would see all these wonderful instrumentalists, and I just felt I had to be on their level, so I worked. It was as easy as that.
One of your mentors was Vladimir Horowitz. How did you meet him?
I met him very early in my life, at the age of about 18 or 17, when I was in Marlborough, and Mr. Serkin told me that Mr. Horowitz wanted to teach somebody, and he thought that I should work with him. And so I played to Mr. Horowitz at that age, and he did want to work with me. But as I told him much later, and as he himself surmised, I was too frightened, actually, to study with him. So I didn't study with him at that age. But he watched me all along, kept an eye on me. I went over his house occasionally. And then much later in my life, towards the last 4 years of his life, actually, I think I was already 40, then I went to him for some coaching, I guess, or talking about music. It was more informal than actual lessons, but I did play to him quite a bit, and I had the enormous privilege of having him play for me and hearing him play.
What were you afraid of when you were a teenager and he offered to work with you?
I don't completely know. I think such a big personality at 18 is a bit daunting. And there was another aspect to me at 18. I wanted to find my own way. I wanted to know what was important for me musically. I just felt the need to see what I needed. And I thought a personality like Horowitz would be too difficult for me to deal with.
Because you'd have to follow his way and not be able to listen to your own?
Yes, or I would be too daunted by it and feel too small in comparison to it. Or, I don't know. It was an instinctual reaction rather than a thought-out reaction.
No, I've read that he gave you the advice, if you want to be more than a virtuoso, first you have to be a virtuoso. What did he mean by that?
He saw that I hadn't played any of the virtuoso repertoire for the piano, the Liszt, the Rachmaninoff, Scriabin, all the difficult virtuoso pieces, that I had mainly done the classical repertoire, Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn. And he said, if you want to be a poet or a philosopher and play that music, that's fine. But in order, as he said, to be more than a virtuoso, first you had to conquer all the difficulties of being a virtuoso, which is the piano, the possibilities of the piano and mastering them, the sounds that a piano could give you. And he was absolutely right.
Why had you avoided until then the more romantic composers?
I wouldn't say romantic, because I had played Schumann and Chopin, but I would say virtuosic.
Mm-hmm.
Partly it was a prejudice that I had, that the music wasn't worthy, and it's a false prejudice.
But that it was really flashy, showy?
Yeah, and that's, in a way, a false prejudice, because Horowitz is right. Until you can make that music sound convincing, then you don't have the resources to approach the great music.
So when you started playing Rachmaninoff, Scriabin. How did you approach it? I mean, because if you were turned off by the more of kind of flashy showman aspects of it, did you
See, through Horowitz's coaching and through his inspiration, I was able to see the excitement of color, of the emotionalism of that music on its own level. And I could see that you couldn't just go through the motions of playing, let's say, octaves or difficult bits correctly, that wouldn't have been enough, that this music had a spark of something that you had to bring to life. And I was able to see it through his eyes.
Why don't we listen to a 1990 recording of yours of Rachmaninoff's Etude No. 5 in E-flat minor. Do you want to say anything about this?
No, this was one of the pieces that I worked on with Horowitz. And I must say that in that period, and probably still now, I have an affection for the music, though I can see that it's not as developmentally interesting as Beethoven. It doesn't have the... I don't know what the right word is, imagination musically, but it's sincere, I think, worthy music on its own terms.
I think it's quite beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why don't we hear it? That's Murray Pariah at the piano, and that Rachmaninoff Etude is included on his CD, Murray Pariah 25th Anniversary Edition, and his new CD features him performing Bach piano concertos. Do you still perform that Rachmaninoff piece?
No, I haven't had occasion to, although for my own pleasure, I go through a lot of Rachmaninoff, especially in the summer. I do the preludes. I look at the concertos. No, I don't ignore him.
And the summer has to do with your performance schedule, not with the temperature.
No, that's right. It has to do with that I don't have concerts.
My guest is pianist Murray Pariah. On his new CD, he performs Bach keyboard concertos. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Murray Pariah is my guest, and he has a new recording of Bach's keyboard concertos. Getting back to Horowitz, you were apparently the last person to hear him play. You were in his apartment the night before he died.
I was.
Do you remember what he was playing and what he was saying about it?
Oh, very, very clearly. He played for me a Liszt arrangement, I think, of a Bach chorale, Weinenklagen, Sorgensagen. And then we talked a lot about Mozart, who is a composer he loved, especially towards his last few years. And I just remember that he was calm and that there was a lot of wisdom, I felt, and that he had a turbulent few months right before that. I don't quite know why.
What do you mean when you say turbulent?
Well, erratic. He wanted to concertize suddenly again, but he wasn't practicing. He wanted very much to make this last recording, which he did. And I don't know, I felt it was turbulent, a little chaotic. Doing things at the last minute, organizing, for instance, a recital, and he hadn't really been working towards this recital, and it would have been about 2 weeks after he died. And suddenly there was a calm in him that I felt that night, and that everything had gone back to, well, the Horowitz that I knew. And so it seemed much more relaxed, and I was very, very relieved about it, and then suddenly he died.
When you became close to him during the last few years of his life, did hearing him play and hearing him talk about music affect you? Did it give you ideas or change your direction? You know, outside of playing more of the virtuoso.
Yes, it did. And I saw what a genuine musician he was, how motivated he was by the music. That this was not the showman that had been depicted, let's say, on films or what one heard, that this was really a man whose life was determined by music and who music mattered a lot to him. Everything in his life revolved around the music. And also he read a lot, too. He read a lot the letters of Mozart, the biographies, all the things around the music as well. He was a very knowledgeable musician. That was a side that the public didn't know.
Did you find it very reassuring, may or may not be the word I'm thinking of here, to know that someone like Horowitz could like live a long life and keep playing to the absolute very end?
It was quite amazing, actually. But, you know, there's only one Horowitz.
True, right.
Yeah, it's unique. The man's energy, and it's more than energy. The demons and the angels, he would say, inside him were something amazing to behold.
Were you able to see those demons and angels close up?
Yeah, I did.
What were some of the demons?
Well, they're harder to describe, but I think they're the things that pushed him in a way. And, for instance, I saw him once get very angry at a recording session when he couldn't get a certain passage and start speaking in Russian. I don't think he was saying nice things. Turbulent would be the best word I could say.
Well, do you feel that for you too? It's the demons as well as the angels that drive you?
Yeah, that's right. But for me, it's a different thing as well. One of the things that I most occupied with is understanding. I don't know whether that was the case for Horowitz. For me, to understand organically the music is the most important thing. Why is this note there, and why is it not another note? And this is something almost that doesn't have to do with performance. It has to do with more abstract thought. That, for some reason, really occupies me.
So you think Horowitz is more intuitive and you have a more intellectual, analytical approach?
Perhaps, yes.
Do you ever worry about memory loss and performance? And I don't mean like Alzheimer's disease. I just mean like in the normal course of things, as people get a little older, they remember a little less.
Yeah, I do a little bit, but it's not a huge problem for me. And I would also get back to this idea of the division between what's analytical and what is inspirational or intuitive. I don't make such a division myself. And I think it's a fine line. I think that all of music is intuitive at some level. There might be more armor in terms of intellectual thought, but still the choices are intuitive. They're based on some inner compulsion that you can't completely analyze.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Murray Pariah has a new CD on which he performs Bach keyboard concertos. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Bantam Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The True Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, African writer Emmanuel Dongala. With the help of writers Philip Roth and William Styron, he was able to flee his home in the Congo after the outbreak of civil war and is now teaching in the U.S. Two of his novels have just been published here. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.